Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we are on facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about health insurance reform in the state of New Mexico. I'm very happy now to welcome Lama Ole Naidal. He is a teacher in the Diamond Way School of Tibetan Buddhism, and he will be in Albuquerque tonight speaking in a lecture titled Buddhism in the Modern World at 8 o'clock at the Embassy Suites Hotel at 1000 Woodward Place Northeast in Albuquerque. He's founded over 500 meditation centers worldwide. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Yes.
So the first question I wanted to ask you was, in the Buddhist tradition, there is something called mind, which is perhaps not the same thing that we think of when we say, I have something on my mind. What is the Buddhist concept of mind?
Well, mind is actually, on the highest levels of teaching, everything is mind. If nothing is there, it's the space aspect of mind. If something manifests, it's mind's free play, and the fact that both can be there is mind's unlimited expression. So actually, in Buddhism, everything is mind. We usually think, of course, we think of something near consciousness and soul, awareness, you know, things like that. But in Buddhism, in the vastest sense, everything is mind.
So is there such a thing as a person's individual mind in the Buddhist sense?
Well, there is in the way, not in the way that it stays and doesn't change, but as a flow, yes. I mean, we all have different bodies and different experiences and so on, and they move through. But awareness itself, the mirror behind the pictures, the ocean underneath the waves, the awareness, which is conscious of things, is the same in everybody.
So did mind always exist before human minds were thinking, before life on Earth, before the Big Bang? I mean, how are we to understand this?
Yes, before Big Bang, you know, space, it's timeless. Space contains past, present, and future. It was always and everywhere, and it was, you know, and Big Bangs come and go, all things come and go, but space, with all its potential and its free play, you know, is always and everywhere. So it's a dimension we cannot go beyond.
So I imagine that the practice of what you do, Buddhist practice, what you teach other people to do, helps individuals to come to a clearer understanding of mind. What are the methods that you use?
Well, you cannot see mind, but you can be mind. You know, mind is not a thing. It has no color, weight, smell, size, or anything like that. But if we rest in our depth, if we remove all the veils, this emptiness of substance, you know, which actually in its true essence is space, you know, experiences itself as being immense bliss. And this space bliss experience is actually what we try to bring people to through our meditational methods. But of course, you know, if we haven't meditated in former lives, you know, it's quite a long shot, right? And even if we have done things in former lives and we are open to the different teachings and so on, we still have to work a lot. And, well, what do? We try to keep three pillars aware: the pillar of right information, where people, you know, are really told how things work, how things are. And the second pillar is that of meditation, where we take that which we accepted and considered valuable from the head to the heart and make it a part of our lives. And thirdly, you know, we also really try to avoid that we try to avoid being disturbed out of that, you know. So we try to keep views or have ways of behaving that avoids being disturbed, you know, and gives us a chance to do as much for others as we possibly can.
What is the mechanism by which meditation actually changes a person? What is actually happening in the mind and body that is different from our regular life?
Well, you become aware of that which is between the thoughts, behind the thoughts, and which knows the thoughts. We can become aware of consciousness itself, of that which is looking through our eyes and listening through our ears. That's what we notice. That's what we become aware of. While most people only see the pictures in the mirror, we see both the mirror and its pictures. That is what we are looking to. That's what we are looking to obtain, and that is actually an exceedingly happiness-bringing and full experience. It's very enjoyable.
When you use words like the mirrors and the pictures and so on, they're metaphors. Do we have, at this point, an actual understanding of what's going on a physiological level?
Well, physiological level, yes. I mean, you can put electrodes on a meditator's brain, and you will see that things happen in there, that certain patterns change, that especially in the frontal lobes there are certain unusual activities and so on. And that's where the mirror recognizes itself. That's where the state of awareness becomes aware of itself. And when we have that all the time, then actually there is no other goal to look for. Because when we recognize mind to be space, well, we become fearless because space cannot be harmed. Then when from that level of fearlessness we see the free play of things inside and outside, we become rich. We think, wow, look at this, so many things are possible. And finally, when we discover that there is no ending or separation between, no ending to mind and no separation between others and ourselves, then we become kind. So these three qualities, you know, are actually what you can see developing in a brain that goes into these different states of meditation.
It's difficult, I think, for those who have not experienced what you're talking about to grasp it, because, of course, we are products of evolution. We are animals. We are living in our bodies. No matter how much we say there isn't separation between you and me, there is. You are Ole Lama Nyaidal. I am Mary Charlotte.
Yeah, I mean, in the outer form there is, you know, but in the basic essence, you know, on the absolute level, everybody's mind is clear space. It's true that, you know, you may have I'm sitting here, up here in Wisconsin, I'm looking out at some trees with no leaves on them right now through a window, and you may be looking at some sandy dunes or something like that. But at the same time, you know, that which is looking is the same in everybody. There's the space making things possible, and there's an awareness which knows and understands. So if you really look at it, you know, it's that which sees is the same. What manifests in the mirror is different. And it's a question of what one considers most important. Most people will take the images in the mirror as most important and not even see the mirror. But what happens through meditation is one sees the mirror. And this brings these very satisfying experiences that I talked about. Fearlessness, when we know the mirror is not a thing, hasn't been made or created, won't die and disappear. Then joy, seeing how rich is all the imagery, all the things that can be experienced by mind, how exceedingly rich it is. And finally, compassion, when we see that all beings want happiness and want to avoid suffering just like us. And we see there are so many and we are just one, so somehow they must be more important than we are. And if we have these three qualities, I would say we are actually doing very well. I would say this is the goal this is really the goal of working with mind.
People who are not meditators, who are not on the path to enlightenment, also experience joy and satisfaction. There's the satisfaction after having had a wonderful meal or friendship. There's the joy in having, a wonderful relationship with somebody, for example. Yes. How are those similar and different to the kinds of joy and satisfaction you're talking about?
Well, the joys we should actually have, you know, and get into as much as we can while we are here in our bodies, are conditioned joys. They appear when certain conditions come together. They change as the conditions change, and they disappear again. While the joy of experiencing mind's own radiance, mind's power of being aware, the ability of owning the cinema and not going for a film, right, which will change, it may and may not be good. You know, this experience is what I talk about. It's a lasting thing. If you have a basis for your happiness which is lasting, like the space, awareness, joy, free play of your mind, you know, you can never lose. Other things are conditioned. They stay for a while. You know, a beautiful love affair may disappear when one has to move away because of a job or whatever else happens, right? So unconditioned happiness, that's what we are looking for in Buddhism, something that you have no matter what happens, because simply because mind is so rich in itself.
When you are able to be in that state of consciousness, how does it change the way that you experience, for example, physical pain?
Well, I just had an example, you know, a couple of years ago. My 88th parachute jumped. I made the mistake of going into meditation, so I forgot to look at the altimeter, and I got really bashed, and I nearly died. Landed on concrete, you know, and got really, really bashed. Right? So, yeah, what can I say? Well, it was painful. It wasn't pleasant. It was quite painful lying there for weeks where they didn't really know how bad it was, you know, and tried to get my right leg to look more or less like it did before and stuff like that and so on, right? And but it was, above all things, it was interesting. I noticed that before I hadn't really known pain. So I always thought, you know, if people had pain, I always thought, why are they doing that? You know, I just looked at them like some strange phenomenon. But here I was really confronted with it, and that was quite interesting, I must say. It was quite a thing. I felt solidarity with the suffering masses for the first time.
Did your ability to practice meditation help you?
Yeah, I probably not actually, but because I'm always in the pure land. I always see everything as pure. Then the doctors didn't know what was going on because I never complained. I just said, "Oh, I have a bit here, but it'll probably go away, and I'm sure this." And while I was bleeding internally, you know, and my lungs were collapsed and everything, right? And I was just in my pure land, telling them that everything was beautiful and wonderful and how good they were and how nice it was that I could be there and stuff like that. So they had no idea what was going on, you know, because I wasn't reacting like a normal patient.
And that was so interesting.
It nearly killed me, I can tell you that. It took a long time before they started doing all the putting me in a tube and x-raying me in all kinds of ways. And then they really found out what had happened. But that was after a week, and I was nearly dead at that time. So it was quite dangerous to be such a stoical, you know, well-meditating Buddhist patient. You know, it was not the healthiest thing to be.
So by being that way, you actually were inhibiting the doctors from seeing what your symptoms
were.
I
wasn't really with the pain. I just thought it wasn't there before, won't be there later, won't worry now, and then I was off again, you know. Yeah, I did. It was dangerous, you know. I should have behaved normally, and I didn't.
We're talking to Lama Oled Naidal, who will be speaking tonight in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's a teacher in the Diamond Way School of Tibetan Buddhism. In one of your books, you talked about the role of critical thinking in Buddhist practice. What is that? What's that part all about?
That part is all about Buddha's last words when he died, and at the age of 80, with all his friends around him in a little place called Kushanaga, or Happiness Town, in northeastern India. And because he'd been eating some bad food from a smith called Kunda, who was probably a very good smith but a bad cook, right? And when he lay down in order to die, then he said some things to his students. First he said, "I can die happily. I didn't keep a single teaching in a closed hand. Whatever can benefit you, I already gave." Then probably somebody looked a bit fundamentalistic. Now what must we believe, you know, and stuff like that, you know, got a bit dramatic. And then he said after that, "Now don't believe a single word just because the Buddha told you, but check it all out yourselves." And the last thing he said was, "Be your own guiding light. Trust your own critical intelligence." So that, I would say, was a very interesting statement, you know, in a world of religions where you are told to follow and believe, you know, Buddha is telling us to check, you know, and examine and so on.
So is that built into the practice of learning to be a Buddhist practitioner?
Yes, of course it is. I mean, there's no faith, there's no beliefs, there are no dogmas in Buddhism. We don't have that. We give advice about what kinds of activity bring happiness and what brings suffering, and if people are smart enough to use it, they will have certain benefits in their lives, right? Then we help them develop their inner life. We bring a good balance between compassion and wisdom. And finally, also, we like to give them the highest view that truth, in order to be true, must be all-pervading, always and everywhere, and that we are all Buddhas who just haven't found it out yet. Which is also, again, a quote from Buddha himself, that the only difference between him and us was the fact that he meditated more.
It's interesting that you say that, because when you tell the story of the life of the Buddha, he was born a very special person, and people who came to him to prophesy, to make a prophecy about his life for his parents, saw that he was this very special person, and they're therefore really different from, you know, me or everybody else sitting in this cafe, perhaps. Are we all really potential Buddhas?
Yeah, everybody is. Mind is like space, and the only reason we can even think of enlightenment or be inspired by enlightenment somewhere else is that we have these qualities in ourselves. This is how it is. We are all Buddhas who didn't find it out yet, and also no Buddha can add anything to the content of our mind, to our potential. All the Buddha does is to remove the veils that keep us from experiencing it. Everybody has what we call Buddha nature. And it's something, you know, that cannot be taken away from one. It's just a question of how many veils are there hiding one from it. And the more veils, the more suffering, the more confusion, the more pain, and so on.
Again, veil is a metaphor. What do you mean by a veil? What does it mean
when
somebody has...
A veil is something that keeps you from seeing what's going on, right?
Uh-huh.
Doesn't have to be like the Muslim ladies who walk around like tents. It can also just be a small, you know, darkness in one's glasses or something like that, right? But everybody who's not enlightened has different kinds of veils, right?
So what are some examples of those?
Well, mixed feelings, stiff ideas, you know, habitual thoughts, unclear perception, you know, all these are veils that keep our mind from seeing and realizing its essence.
I think when people start practicing meditation, their motivation is often, for example, to become more compassionate, but not necessarily to eradicate all desire. Is it okay to set smaller goals on the path that fall short of total enlightenment?
No, I mean, desires, you know, I mean, the speech about desires is mainly for monks and nuns, right, who live celibate. I mean, and who sort of live as far away from the ordinary world as they can, with as few attachments and so on as possible. But for lay people, it's a question of doing things for the benefit of everybody. I mean, if you enjoy with others, or you enjoy with the idea of everybody having that happiness or sharing that happiness with you and so on, then there's nothing wrong with that. Then it's not a problem. Then even when we die, it's not a problem. But if we, you know, if we are personally attached and think my this, my that, and I must have, and I mustn't lose, and so on, then it's true. Then it is painful. Then it is a problem.
One of the things I appreciate about Buddhism as a, I don't know if you want to call it a religion, but as a way of life, is that it is very scientific and recognizes science and embraces science. I was just at a conference on evolution in which they were talking about the way that things are transmitted. Obviously, through evolution, things are transmitted through the genes. There are also languages transmitted from one person to another. But then there is this whole, in Buddhism and in a lot of Eastern religions, this concept of reincarnation where, mm-hmm. I guess you would call it the soul gets transmitted. How does that happen? What is the mechanism by which a life is transmitted into another body in Buddhist theory?
Yeah, I mean, all the many incarnates we have and so on. Well, what to say about it, we usually think that the brain produces mind, right? But if we look at the experiments of people under clinical death and so on, we actually get the understanding that mind can also function separately from the body. I mean, people who were clinically dead, you know, have been revived and were then able to tell what was happening in the room while they were clinically dead and treated like that. There's a special one, Van Lommel, a Dutch doctor, you know, has done intensive studies on that, and there are many others also. So it seems that mind is not produced by the body, it's transformed by the body. That mind is like a stream of energy awareness which leaves one body and moves through, you know, different kinds of psychological changes during 7 weeks or not more than 7 weeks, and then it unites with another existence which fits its subconscious content. And that is what we, that's what we have from the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And I've taught over 70,000 people POA, conscious dying, you know, and since 87 in 12 to 13 courses every year, sometimes with thousands of people in Europe and so on. And this is definitely something that works and happens. It does bring the results.
What is meant by the phrase, the liberation of all sentient beings? That's something one hears a lot in relation to Buddhism.
Well, yes, it means that all beings get the chance to decide not just what their body should do and eat and where it should go, but also the chance to decide what the mind should experience. That's liberation. When we stop feeling like the target, when we stop thinking that we are a something or a somebody separate from others and other beings, when we do that, then you can really say that we are free.
All sentient beings includes pythons and termites and parrots and so on. Do they count?
Whoever has a mind, you know, whoever has a mind, but it's not that we expect to finish it this weekend, right? We do think we'll have to come back a few times to do it, but that is, yes, you are right, it includes everything having a mind.
And that those animals in their state would be liberated and make those choices?
Yeah, we think that as mind develops, you know, we'll get bodies or carriers of these minds that become ever finer. And from the human body, then one can go on to what's called pure lands, energy fields created by Buddhas. And then there one can really learn and develop a lot. And from there one can be a Buddha or Bodhisattva oneself.
So enlightenment always has to happen in the human form.
Yeah, it's best from the human form. It really is. You can also get it in the Pure Lands, but it's better, you know, it's better to do it here because we have the body, we can hold the mind through the body, and that means we can focus better. If there's no body, our mind is wherever we think, and then it's much more difficult.
Tell us a little bit, if you don't mind, about how you came to this whole set of teachings and bringing this teaching to so many people in the West.
Well, I actually, you know, I probably didn't have any choice. My wife also didn't really have any choice because already when we were children, we were behaving, you know, in a lot of ways, the way that East Tibetans, people from Eastern Tibet behave. And I, for instance, in Denmark, which is totally flat, you know, I was always making painting mountain warfare, right? And men and women in red skirts, you know, and we don't have men with red skirts in Denmark. You know, that's what the lamas wear, right?
Right.
And also in 86, my wife and I went secretly across Eastern Tibet, you know, to places where no white man has been before. And they really, and you know, and we recognized a lot of places, and also the places we had been together with our Lama, the 16th and the 15th Karmapas, you know, in our last life. So we recognized a lot of things, found a lot of things, you know, it was very impressive. And actually the Tibetans say that I am a Buddhist protector, that the reason I could start over 600 centers and get things to work so well around the world is actually that it's not the first life I do it.
And so you met a Buddhist teacher who
then transmitted. First we went through, you know, the whole psychedelic thing in the 60s. Then we saw that our friends started dying and getting funny and getting into trouble and stuff like that with the chemicals. And then we said, okay, you know, and then we heard about the Hindus first, but they were too soft for Danish, too sweet for Danish taste. They really were. But then we heard about the Tibetans and especially the Eastern Tibetans who fought so well against the Chinese and so on, who were such brave resistance fighters. And of course it touched us because during the Second World War, my father was helping getting Jews from Denmark over to Sweden, which was neutral and so on. So we actually, it really struck a note. And all the time, every time we heard about something happening, you know, in Central Asia and so on, we had this feeling, you know, that, wow, you know, this is interesting. It's more interesting than what happens in other places and so on. And there then we saw these places and also our lamas, our teachers and colleagues also, right? They also consider me a protector and so on. So that's what I'm doing. So now there's no doubt that when one sees the things one knows from the last life, it's not just a short déjà vu. It's like really you go in there, you know how it is, right? You are totally struck, and you're struck for a long time and so on. So it's different, you know. It's not just like your mind receiving the same impetus twice, once intuitively and once over different sensors in the brain, which makes it appear a fraction of a second later, which is the reason for most déjà vus. But this is like really, you know, you just know it, you know, and there's no doubt.
You know, I've often wondered that experience of knowing something and having no doubt. That is something that you describe, and that certain musicians and artists describe, and they go on to do wonderful things. But what about people who also have that just no doubt that this is their path and it's a destructive path? How do you understand that? Being a gangster or something like that?
Or an Islamic bomber, right? A suicide bomber or something like that. I think that if it's self-destructive, it probably is brainwash. It probably is a strong influence from evil ideology or some other kind of heavy influence from the outside. Usually people will not do that unless they are under, let's say, unhealthy influence, right? So I would say, I would say that it's not something one should consider, you know, very high. Everything should be measured. Everything happening should be measured by the human values, by human constitutions, and actually, I always have a little book of the American Constitution with me, a little leather thing, you know. I like it, you know. It's really the best of the period of enlightenment and we the people and so on. I really thoroughly like that and so on. And there we have to watch out not to get too technical in Europe, you know, and too politically correct and everything. But we really stay with the basics. That's an important point.
What is the significance of the diamond in the Diamond Way School of Tibetan Buddhism?
Well, the diamond is, first, it's nearly unbreakable, and secondly, it's naturally radiant. Some people think when we say Diamond Way that we are trying to get all the rich ladies to visit us, you know, who who have been told that a diamond is a woman's best friend and so on. But it's not that. It's actually, it's direct translation of what Buddha said. He said Vajrayana or Dorje Tekpa in Sanskrit or Tibetan. And it simply means Diamond Way. It means the king of the stones, the hardest stone, the unbreakable stone. You know, it's the diamond. So I just translated. I wasn't out there trying to look for a nice name, you know, but it's what Buddha called this ultimate level of his teachings.
In Santa Fe, we have many practitioners of meditation, Buddhism of all kinds. If there's one problem you've seen among your Western students, what is it, and how do you help them to correct it so that they can advance in their practice?
No, there are so many people coming, you know, that I more filter and then send people somewhere else than if they do, then if I know that they would not really benefit from our practice but benefit more from other practices, you know, I more or less make it clear very, very quickly. For instance, I always show, you know, talk about the beauty of sexuality and love and so on. And that means that people leave who are neurotic and don't like that, you know, and they want it to be very holy and dead from the waist and down and so on. And then I also say, you know, as I've mentioned, the danger of Islam, and then the people who are afraid of a bomb under their car, they leave, right? And then the rest is actually a good crowd and so on, and they can usually understand, and also the groups themselves inspire and influence themselves. You know, we're not like putting down a set thing. Of course, we have to have certain things to be legal, and we have that, and we take care of things and so on. But actually, it's really a question of giving people leeway to express themselves and to grow into groups and attract each other and learn from each other and so on.
What will you be speaking about at the lecture in Albuquerque tonight?
I'm not sure. I'll be looking at the faces, and then I will see how many fingers between eyebrows and hairline, and then I will start.
What does that mean?
How bright they look.
Lama Ole Nyadal is a teacher in the Diamond Way School of Tibetan Buddhism, and once again, he will be in Albuquerque speaking tonight. That's at 8 o'clock at the Embassy Suites Hotel at 1000 Woodward Place Northeast in Albuquerque. Also, today at 10 o'clock, there is a brunch and a blessing. There's a small donation requested for the lunch. And for more information, you can call 505-850-6107. There is a group in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that you can reach them through calling 603-5953. And for more information, diamondway.org. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, yes, thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Mary Feldblum. She's the executive director of the Health Security for New Mexicans campaign. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Now, we see you pretty much every year during the legislative session. You've been working for a very long time on health insurance reform within the state of New Mexico that would give far more people access to affordable health care. Tell us about your group, Health Security for New Mexicans.
We're the largest coalition in the history of our state, 146 organizations. And for over 12 years, we have been working on a proposal that is called the Health Security Act that would enable New Mexico to set up its own health plan for most New Mexicans. The military, for example, would retain their own health care system, as would the federal retirees. And the tribes could voluntarily join, as could large companies that self-insure. But most New Mexicans would be covered under this plan, and with a state with a small population, it makes an enormous amount of sense to do something like this. Complete freedom of choice of doctor and hospital, including across state lines. A fabulous benefit package, no less than what state employees have. That includes acupuncture, mental health. It's really nice, comprehensive package. Administered by, it's sort of like a co-op, a citizens board that's geographically representative from around the state that includes 10 consumer business folks, 5 health facility providers, and essentially would be responsible for administering the plan with the CEO and the staff. Everything is open to the public, so they can't do anything behind closed doors. So it's, in that sense, it's like a co-op. And it's paid for by using existing taxpayer dollars that already go to health care like this, for instance, a lot of Medicaid, and combining that with premiums based on people's income and employer contributions. And in addition, people would find out that their auto insurance is reduced as well as workers' comp for businesses. All of this to be done with what we call a go-slow process, the first year focusing on numbers. Can we really afford this? And the Legislative Finance Committee would be in charge of crunching those numbers. There'd be public input into it. If it's not affordable, there's a sunset clause in the bill, so it's very unusual. And if it is affordable, and there have already two studies that indicate that our state would save billions of dollars over time if we did this, that the next phase is very important with public input to figure out the details of this plan. So that's basically it in a nutshell. The legislation hasn't been introduced. Our biggest opposition is the insurance industry, because basically what we're saying is it makes a lot of sense in our state to shift the role of private insurance just the way Medicare, the original Medicare, did. So people can buy more if they want. Employers can buy more as a supplemental market. But they cannot compete with this particular plan. This plan essentially would cover people regardless of health condition, regardless of age, regardless of employment status. It's really health security.
When you talk about the cost savings, are the savings in cost, where do they come from? I mean, are they purely the profit that isn't going into the insurance company's pockets, or does it come from someplace else as well?
It also comes from the complex system that we have. There are Loveless and Presbyterian. They offer hundreds of insurance policies, and that impacts overhead for hospitals, impacts overhead for doctors' offices. And so essentially eliminating the middle person allows for greater administrative simplicity. In addition, the pharmacists support this. There would be bulk purchasing of drugs, so we'd get discounted prices for drugs and other types of equipment. And so there's an enormous amount of savings. Two times there have been studies commissioned in our state, one in 1994 and one in 2007. Both studies essentially concluded that by pooling most New Mexicans in one old-fashioned health risk pool, there would be billions of dollars saved.
So that is the Health Security for New Mexicans campaign, and we've talked about it before, and no doubt we'll talk about it again on this program. How does what you are proposing intersect with the federal health insurance reform plans in the House and Senate as they now exist?
Well, the federal plans, whether they're the House bill or the Senate two bills, which have been merged and nobody knows what's in them, the merged version yet, really rely on the private insurance system. And so what the federal bill will do, no matter which one comes out, will set up what's called an insurance market exchange, which is one-stop shopping for the uninsured and for small employers. And how that's defined will depend ultimately on some final numbers. The House bill says the first year it's for employers with 25 or less employees, but the Senate bills have higher standards. So essentially, you have to be what's called insurance market exchange eligible to purchase health care in the insurance market exchange. In addition, the House bill has a public option, so that if I'm uninsured, I would be required to buy insurance now. I would get a subsidy to help me pay for the premium depending on my income. And I would have a choice of using private insurance plans or what's called the public option or the public plan. All of this is based on a competitive insurance market model. And it's a very different kind of model. It's a model that Massachusetts has used. Massachusetts really didn't have a public option, but it required all their residents to purchase health insurance. And there are no built-in premium controls in the bill, although the House bill does have a monitoring system about premiums. But there's really no setting of premium rates, so there's no guarantee that the subsidy that I get this year will cover me for next year. Congress is not going to change the private insurance system. I think that's very, very clear. But what there is sentiment for is what we would call state experimentation. One of the interesting things is that the national bill allows states to set up insurance market exchanges. The Senate is talking about an opt-out for those states that don't want to have a public option. We'll see what happens there, whether that persists. But ultimately, it's a competitive insurance market model. Some states are considering are models that are different. In New Mexico, as I said earlier, what we want to do is set up our own health insurance plan that shifts the role of private insurance to a supplemental one. So it's not a competitive model. The private insurance industry can't compete with this public plan. And what that means is there is a predictable market, predictable costs, particularly since we're using the state employee plans, which has a strong, very good actuarial experience that one can base costs on. And it's proven to save money. So what the Senate is considering is actually waiver language, which is in a lot of bills or laws like Medicaid. There are waivers that one can get so that states don't have to necessarily set up an insurance market exchange. They'd have to fulfill certain criteria, so they can't get away with not insuring their folks, but they could do it in a different way. And that makes a lot of sense to continue to allow state experimentation. We have been pushing hard for that language, and we've gotten wonderful support from Senator Bingaman and Senator Udall in the Senate. On the House side, there Representative Kucinich got an amendment on one of the three House bills that didn't survive the House merged bill. In essence, it was what people called a single-payer amendment, allowing states to receive waivers for ERISA, is that ERISA plans, large companies that self-insure, and they could set up a single-payer system and include them. But that amendment has not survived, and so we'll see what happens in the House, because the House bill, Senate bill, will have to ultimately, if the Senate bill passes, will go into conference. And so it's anybody's guess what will ultimately come out of conference committee.
I think this is a great example of legislation where a few details can make gigantic differences in people's lives. For example, if a subsidy is available to buy health insurance for people with a certain income level or whatever, and the following year the insurance company jacks your rate up 30% and the subsidy doesn't go up, you're in big trouble.
Absolutely. And in Massachusetts, they have acknowledged that they haven't been able to control premiums. And so they have some kind of a commission now that's set up to try and deal with that. But it's a major problem. And the insurance industry doesn't like to be controlled. It's really questionable. Already the pharmaceutical company, front page of New York Times today, says the pharmaceutical companies are jacking up their costs for drugs in anticipation of health care reform. And I think people are starting to see that with the private insurance system here. There may be states that where a private insurance system, if it's regulated properly, can work. In our state, we have a small population. It simply doesn't make sense to have multiple plans, multiple companies, and particularly since it's been demonstrated that our state would save substantial money. What's exciting about the national plan for us is that the subsidies then would be available for our state as well. And that's what we're pushing for.
So this is an example of a campaign that you've been at for a long time where legislation on the national level could actually advance the cause of universal health care for New Mexicans, even if we didn't use the federal plan.
Yes, it could really help provide additional financial resources to the state. There are financial resources available to states that want to set up co-ops within an insurance market exchange model, so there's no reason why they can't set up, you know, allow for those planning monies to help with our state. And so that's what we're pushing for, is to make sure that any federal resources available to states that set up insurance market exchanges or co-ops could also be available to states like New Mexico that, you know, that set up something different.
In the couple of minutes that we have left, what are you encouraging people to do at this point?
Well, we have always been encouraging people to let their congressmen know and the senators know that they would like to see language in the final bill that allows state experimentation. That's at what's called waiver language or state flexibility language. And communicating that through letters or calls is really, really important. People can connect to our website. We have some position papers on this, www.nmhealthsecurity.org. And you can also contact us if you want more information. We're finding that because so many people are so concerned about and upset with what the politics that are going on in D.C., it's becoming more and more obvious that states need to be able to take control of some of this process and to make sure that their citizens are represented well in terms of health care. And we have a much better chance of developing something that's ours here in New Mexico. How many of us are going to go to Washington, D.C. to deal with the regulatory process? We're not. Most, you know, it is going to be the national organizations that do that. And so this way, if we set up our own health plan, people could come and participate in the meetings of our health plan.
Mary Feldblum is Executive Director of the Health Security for New Mexicans campaign, which is on the web at nmhealthsecurity.org. It's a coalition of 146 different organizations. Give us just an example of some of the kinds of folks who have joined into this campaign.
Well, aside from physicians, the pharmacists, and nurses, there are the New Mexico Seiki Association, there's labor, there's LULAC, there's human service type organizations, community organizations. It is so broad. And what we're very proud of is that it's very geographically representative from around the state. This is not an Albuquerque or just Santa Fe campaign, but people and organizations from all around the state have had input and support this plan. And we're excited because people are seeing how important it is now. And hopefully the national legislation can just help our state do what it really needs to do, which is really serve our people in the best way that we think is needed.
Mary Feldblum, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's Doubtfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.